The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I'm Brent Nuchtigall and I'll be guest hosting today on this program. Thanks very much for tuning in. We are here in Jerusalem, Israel, where a lot of people are starting to trickle in to the Holy Land for the celebration of the fall festival, starting with trumpets, then onto Yom Kippur or Atonement, and then onto Sukkot or the Feast of Tabernacles. Atonement is just a couple of days away, and then 5 days after that, the Feast of Tabernacles begins, and so there is a lot of people coming into town. Of course, this is just a city where a lot of people would like to celebrate those festivals coming up to Jerusalem, really just looking ahead to the time when the world will be focused on Jerusalem and the feast days, God's feast days, and how they will be kept. Today, I'm not going to talk too much about that, although I did go down to walk through the Old City just yesterday. I have a couple of guests here from former students of Herbert W. Armstrong College. They are en route to South Africa, I believe, to celebrate the feast, and they stopped in here for a few days, and we went down to the City of David and the Ophel and basically ancient Jerusalem and took a tour of those dig sites, something that I've done many, many times now and something that I still enjoy. And they seem to be getting longer. This one took about 4 hours. But thankfully, the people with me, well, they didn't seem too bored with it, and they enjoyed it all. So if we get time, we'll talk a little bit about that later on today's show. But I really do want to focus on instead, we're staying in the Middle East, but just a couple of news stories that could really further destabilize, or events that could really further destabilize the Middle East. And this is something that could really affect you as we'll get to towards the middle part of the program. Looking around the Middle East right now, as I do as the Trumpet's correspondent over here, keeping track of events in numerous countries, events that have biblical significance, searching for fulfillments of biblical prophecies or events that could lead to the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. That's what I do most of my time. And right now, I was just going through a list of crises that we see in the Middle East. And it's severe. It's in almost every country. People might look at the Middle East and say it's very hard to comprehend. And indeed, there are so many moving parts that it can be that way. But one thing you can notice by looking at the Middle East or news reports from here is that there is a lot of turmoil, a lot of crises besetting the region right now. A lot of it has been instigated by the nation of Iran, or I should say the rulership in Iran, the regime in Iran. And we've talked about that at length on this show and others, and we report on that often, how Iran is really driving a lot of biblical prophecies in the Middle East, biblical prophecies that aren't good in the short term. And yet they lead to good results in the end. Not that that is the intent of the Iranian regime at all. But you just see Iran's fingerprints over a lot of the crises throughout the Middle East. So you've got that major power, which we'll talk about a little bit, that's growing. But in the Middle East, it's not just Iran. You have the Islamic State, of course. The Islamic State is still a formidable force in eastern Syria to this day. You have it withdrawing as it gets, as its territory shrinks, as the United States comes from one side, you have Russia and Iran coming from the other side, Kurdish forces coming from another side, trying to really shrink down the territory of the Islamic State. But they still have numerous thousand fighters there. It's still very hard to take them completely because everywhere they leave, they booby trap with explosives. And so it's just very difficult to move fast and trying to stamp out the Islamic State from Syria. So you have the Islamic State there. You still have Syria, of course, is still in its civil war. Other powers, the state, Syrian state, as backed by Russia and Iran, fighting against Syrian rebels that aren't linked to the Islamic State. Numerous factions still fighting with that. Of course, if you look in between those two states, you have Iraq. Iraq is still trying to stamp out the remnants of the Islamic State in its north and west. And so you have a nation that's trying to recover from the fight against the Islamic State, especially in towns that have just been decimated by the Islamic State's retreat and the fight to get rid of the Islamic State. So you have that. You have a government in turmoil as well in Iraq right now. You have the Sunnis basically, all the governmental bills that are passing are backed by the Shiite government, so it's not an inclusive government at all. To the north, you have Kurdistan, as we'll talk about a little bit later on the program, that just have a referendum this week, and they decided that they want to secede from Iraq. And so that's fractured. And then looking across to Lebanon on the coast, you have a completely dysfunctional government. Completely dysfunctional. They're busy trying to deal with the internal struggle between Sunnis and the Shiites, and that gets down, that's on the governmental level with the prime minister being a Sunni, trying to limit the world's retraction from Lebanon, economic retraction, or leaving Lebanon with its business deals because of the rise of Hezbollah. No one really wants to be a part of Lebanon, and it does impact a lot of the people there because of Hezbollah's rise. You also have there inside Lebanon the internal struggle between the Lebanese army and Hezbollah as well. And then you also have the nation burdened down by 25% of its population being refugees still to this day. Syrian civil war might be winding down, but a quarter of the population of Lebanon right next door, who normally has a population of 4 million people, is trying to deal with this influx of refugees from that fight. So that's basically the Middle East. Surrounding Israel, we didn't talk to Jordan. That looks to be somewhat of an island of stability, but for right now. But we'll see about that going into the future. But then you can look over to the Gulf. What's happening there? You have this crisis with Qatar that's still going on. We haven't really talked about it for a while on the Trumpet Hour or written about it because it's just still maintaining the status quo, still a blockade on Qatar by the Saudis, by the Emiratis. They're sick of Qatar siding with Iran. They're sick of them supporting political Islamic takeovers, be it in Egypt or Libya, different terrorist groups. They don't like that. And so they've still got this boycott of Qatar. Then you can move across the peninsula to Yemen. There's another civil war taking place there. The Middle East Second Civil War, the civil war that nobody really talks about, where over 10,000 people have been killed. That's of January this year, and it's gone up by over 1,000 already. There in that nation, you have the Houthis on the western side, the Iranian-backed militia. Well, they're firing about a Scud a week, Scud missile a week into Saudi Arabia to the north. Trying to target not necessarily townships, but oil facilities. Why do they want to do that? Of course, that could hurt the economy of Saudi Arabia a bit, but it would also jeopardize a lot of the economies of the world, especially being so close to the Red Sea. People are watching that. Another nation experiencing upheaval there in Yemen. Then you can go across the Red Sea from Saudi Arabia, and you'll get to Egypt. And you have the current government of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi trying to put a lid on the growing Islamist threat there as well, internally. I mean, we hear about the Islamist attacks and the terrorist attacks in Europe of late, and in Israel, of course. But terrorist attacks take place all the time in the Middle East, completely underreported, because you think it's the Middle East. They're just killing themselves, killing each other. They're all terrorists, aren't they? Well, not so much. Not so much. And Egypt's president is trying to face a terrorist entity, the Islamic State, another province of the Islamic State in the Sinai. He's losing about a dozen men a month of his military men fighting the Islamic State. And not to mention Egypt, of course, is struggling very much internally, really simmering under stringent economic austerity moves by Sisi. The people are. He's trying to rectify Egypt's chronic, sick economy, and he's just hoping that the people are patient with him And he's promising, hey, things are going to get better. Things are going to get better for you economically. We just have to take the hit right now. And yet it doesn't look like better economic times are coming to Egypt. Are they running out of patience there? Again, this is one of the causes that led to the overthrow of Mubarak, these economic woes of Egypt. Then you could just head westward from Egypt. And where you cross the border into Libya, you've got right now about 1,500 independent militias still working to try and secure their own little fiefdom after Gaddafi was removed from power back in 2011 and 2012. Still hasn't recovered from that. Of course, you've got the large large brokers there of power in the east and in the west. But then you have a bunch of militias all through the nation, no central government in Libya. And guess what? The Islamic State there, that's making a comeback as well. Islamic State in Libya. Watch for that. That looks like it's growing. That's what they're saying in Syria. The Islamic State has said in Syria, hey, it looks like we're winding down here. Let's go to Libya. That's an ungoverned space. Let's go there. And they look like they might thrive there even more. And then what else do you have in Libya? You have, because there's no central government and it's all chaotic and fractured, you have thousands upon thousands of migrants from Africa and other parts of Asia. They're pushing into Libya from the south. They're making their journey to the coast, to Libya, try and get into international waters, jump on a boat, a little rubber dinghy, and try and get out into international waters where somebody will save you from the Mediterranean Sea. They don't even hope of landing in Europe. They just think somebody will pick them up. And then, be it, it's considering it's against the law to, if you make it into international waters, to be returned to a country not deemed safe, then you'll have to go to Europe. Well, Europe's trying to figure something out with that and trying to make sure they don't even make it into international waters. They've trained the Libyan Coast Guard. The Libyan Coast Guard, again, there's been many, many, many reports of how they're treating these migrants that don't actually make it to international waters. And so they bring them back into detention facilities, which have been likened to concentration camps. Because again, who's looking after these people? Who's looking after these migrants? The defenseless at this point, having spent a lot of them, their life savings, to try and get to Europe. Well, they're not making it to Europe anymore. They're sitting in detention centers in Libya, thousands of them. Some of them are being deported. Where are they going? Back to the countries they came from, with an equally depressing economic and social problem, societal problems equal with Libya. That's where they're going. So just looking at the Middle East now, we have to ask, will it ever turn around? Will we ever see peace in the Middle East? We talk a lot about Israeli-Palestinian peace, and yet look at the rest of the Middle East. There's no peace there. There's nation fighting against nation, human beings fighting against human beings, plenty of people caught in the middle of power-hungry men. Will it ever get better? Now, it might seem that the Middle East is a world away from you, but the problems of the Middle East will reach you. They will reach you, not before too long. Germany probably didn't think the problems of the Middle East would reach them. But now we have a far-right party in the German Bundestag, a direct result of Angela Merkel's government underestimating the German populace's tolerance for unfettered migration of 1 million people who came through the Middle East to Germany, most of whom they're failing to integrate into German society. Did that affect her? Is that affecting Germany? Is that affecting the other European nations? Of course it is. Britain probably didn't think the Middle East would affect them too much until they let in so many Middle Easterners that failed again to integrate. They probably didn't think of that would affect them, and yet look at all the terrorist attacks that we're seeing right now. It was committed mainly by Middle Easterners, and they're starting to happen at a clip in the UK, similar to what they happen here in Israel. Or you can ask somebody in the United States who's had a family that's lost a soldier in one of the many, many Middle Eastern wars over the past decade and a half. Or you can ask the administration of the United States right now, which is trying to prevent Iran's development of ballistic missiles that they could use to send a warhead to Europe. at this point, they can already do that. A warhead, though, that may be soon tipped with a nuclear weapon if Iran's collusion with North Korea, a new nuclear power, continues. The United States is trying to figure out how to deal with that. Europe soon is going to have to try and figure out how to deal with that, as Israel has been thinking about how to deal with that as well. So you could talk to them. You could talk to global insurers, economists, worried that every time the Houthis in Western Yemen send an explosives-laden boat into a ship in the Red Sea, a key transit point, they're worried that that passage through the Red Sea will be severely limited, drastically affecting the prices of international shipping for goods, for oil. So you may be far from the Middle East, but events that take place here really do affect you. And these problems in the Middle East, they're not going away. Already they have shaken up European affairs dramatically, as you've heard so much on this program. Well, Bible prophecy indicates that these events in the Middle East will only continue to exacerbate world tensions. And all of this, I haven't really talked about Israel, which, although it's one of the islands of stability in the Middle East, is apparently the cause of all of its problems. Well, Israel didn't cause one of those problems that I discussed already. Well, today I want to talk with you about another couple of issues that threaten to destabilize the Middle East further. Now, these specifically aren't necessarily mentioned in Bible prophecy, these couple of items that we'll talk about, but you can see how that will affect the increasing instability of the Middle East. And the Bible is clear that the end times really do take off with growing instability in the Middle East. We're going to take a short break, though, first. And when we come back, we will stick with a couple of stories from this week from the Middle East that definitely bear your vigilance. Stay with us.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The king of the south is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the literature tab to select your free booklet.
The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. I'm Brent Nachtigall again. We're talking about the Middle East, and just we've zoomed out totally and looked at all the problems, or many of the problems that exist in the Middle East. We're not even talking about cultural problems or societal problems, really. We're just talking about the wars and the rumors of wars and the effect that they have, those wars, on you, on Europeans, on Americans, on Israelis, on wherever you are listening to this. The Middle East, events in the Middle East definitely do affect you. Now, the first news story I want to cover here refers to something that took place a couple of days ago. This is where Interpol admitted Palestine as a full member to its group. Now, Interpol is important because they are the largest international body apart from the United Nations. And Interpol enables member states to exchange intelligence, work together to find ways to cope with international crime, including terrorism and including human trafficking. Well, it turns out that Palestine, even though it's not a state yet, well, it's on the way to being, it seems, as we'll talk about. Well, it's been voted in by a majority of Interpol voting member states. They say that Palestine's now in Ramallah, the leadership, the Palestinian Authority. They now have a seat at Interpol. That means that they will start receiving and collaborate with not just the Israeli government. They're going to collaborate with other governments in the world trying to combat terrorism of all things. Now, what's interesting about this, or one point that's interesting about this, is it flies in the face of what we've been hearing about from the current Israeli government, that times are awesome, that we're for Israel, that we have a sea change that's taking place throughout the nations of the world where they're starting to accept Israel. They're starting to embrace Israel. We'll hear a quote just in a second from Mr. Netanyahu saying that. I just want to read a piece that came out yesterday. This is from Raphael Aaron for the Times of Israel. And he records both the details of this vote, but also what it means for Israel's standing in the world. He writes this: in a stinging diplomatic defeat for Israel, the world's largest international police organization on Wednesday accepted the, quote, state of Palestine, end quote, as a full member. At Interpol's annual General Assembly in Beijing, the Palestinians' membership bid was accepted with 75 countries voting yes, 24 voting no, and 34 abstaining. Israel fiercely objected to the Palestinians joining Interpol, arguing that Ramallah's alleged support for terrorism could hinder rather than aid Interpol's efforts. The U.S. administration, too, objected to Ramallah's membership bid and helped Israel to lobby against it. And yet, all the lobbying they could do, all the so-called power that Israel now has with other nations, came to none effect in this vote. Then we have here the Palestinian Foreign Minister, Raed al-Maliki. He welcomed this decision, hailing it a victory for his people. And then he said this: the state of Palestine considers this membership and the responsibilities that it entails as an integral part of its responsibility towards the Palestinian people and a moral commitment to the citizens of the world. That's what he said. And then he said, Palestine's ready to shoulder any of these obligations and responsibilities. So on and so forth. Then he starts talking about the state of Palestine, starts talking about how they want to join as many international institutions as they can. Remember, the state of Palestine doesn't exist. If you lived here, you would know that doesn't exist yet. It does have some cities that it rules over, the Palestinian Authority, that Israel lets them rule over, and that bans Jews from going to. Again, the only places that people can't go in the Middle East or in Israel or in the West Bank or in Gaza. There's plenty of places that you can't go if you're an actual Jew. Palestinians, though, they can generally come through security checks. They can come to any place that they really want to. Nevertheless, we have this situation where we have the Palestinian Authority, currently led by Fatah. That could change. We'll talk about that in a bit as well, and what that would mean for the Palestinian Authority and Interpol. Imagine that. Right now, we've got the Palestinian Authority, led by Fatah, which is considered the more moderate. We'll see in a second how moderate they are. But right now, they're in reconciliation talks with Hamas. So if they get together and they have an election and Hamas wins, then Hamas is on or leads the Palestinian delegation on Interpol. That's quite laughable that would happen. A terrorist group, part of the international body, trying to get rid of terrorism, trying to work together to get rid of terrorism. That could happen from now on, sometime in the future. Anyhow, Raphael Aaron, he says this. He says, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has in recent weeks repeatedly declared that Israel's standing in the international community has never been better, and that the Arabs' automatic majority is quickly eroding. He said on Sunday, this was at the UN, he said, we have many friends. Well, I don't think that was at the UN, that was just after his speech. But then he said, but Wednesday, this is what Raphael wrote, but Wednesday's Interpol vote can be seen as a bitter defeat for Israel's diplomatic efforts. Indeed. Especially since Palestine was admitted to Interpol in a secret ballot. Israeli officials cannot argue that the world's nations secretly support the Jewish state, even if they are still willing to openly side with it. This was done in secret ballot. You would think that if Israel was developing closer and closer ties with nations in the world, and that many of the nations in the world are afraid to speak up publicly about their support for Israel, well, if they're voting in a secret ballot, why would they care? They can vote the way they want. No one would know. And yet that's the way it was. That's the way it was. And still, with all Israel's lobbying, they admitted the Palestinian Authority to Interpol. Now, this is something that I've talked about actually on the Watch Jerusalem program, another program here on KPCG. And I went through a bunch of quotes from Mr. Netanyahu's UN speech to talk about that talks about how he has made huge strides with other nations of the world as far as their relationship goes with Israel. And while I do believe there has been some partial success there, this vote does show that it's not going to last. It won't last. I just do want to play you a clip so you understand what I mean and what's coming from the Israeli government right now, from Mr. Netanyahu, from the UN last week. This is what he said about Israel's relationship with the world. This is just one quote. He said much more, but this is all I'll play for you.
In the past year, Israel has hosted so many world leaders, and I had the honor of representing my country on 6 different continents. 1 year, 6 continents. I went to Africa, where I saw Israeli innovators increasing crop yields, turning air into water, fighting AIDS. I went to Asia, where we deepened our relations with China and with Singapore, and expanded our cooperation with our Muslim friends in Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan. I went to Europe, where in London and Paris, Saloniki and Budapest, we enhance our security and economic ties. I went to Australia, becoming the first Israeli prime minister to visit our great allies down under. And just last week, I went to South America, visiting Argentina and Colombia. And then I went on to Mexico, becoming, if you can believe it, the first Israeli prime minister ever to visit Latin America. After 70 years, the world is embracing Israel, and Israel is embracing the world.
Well, not really after this Interpol vote. It looks like the world is embracing the Palestinian Authority, that to this day really does deny Israel's right to even exist. Now, again, I'm just going to read from this article. This is what Interpol is. The world's biggest international organization after the United Nations, which enables member states to exchange intelligence and to work together to find ways to cope with international crime from terrorism to human trafficking. Okay, is the Palestinian Authority committed to working together to cope with international terrorism or even terrorism in Israel? Well, this is what came out. This is just a little report here from the New York Times. This came out yesterday, and it talks about the terrorist attack that took place inside the West Bank against 3 Israelis that were killed. And this is what Fatah, who leads the Palestinian Authority, who just got admitted to the world body to combat terrorism, to work together with other nations to combat terrorism. And this is what they said. This is from New York Times. Fatah, the Palestinian movement led by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, posted an image of Nimr Jamal, who killed 3 Israeli security personnel and wounded a 4th on Tuesday in Har Adar near Jerusalem, on its official Facebook page, hailing him as a historic martyr. So at the same time, we have terrorism hailed by the Palestinian Authority leadership, we have their admittance to the foremost world body for working together to find ways to cope with international terrorism. What is wrong with the world where most states accept a Palestinian state and want to coordinate with them in the war against terrorism when it actively promotes and praises terrorism against Israel? That's just crazy to me. It happened the very day that terrorist attack took place, and yet here it is. I mean, the world spoke against Israel's wishes in secret ballot and said, come along, Palestinian Authority. We know you're not a state yet. We want your help. We want you to work with us. We'll help you fight terrorism, as they praise a terrorist. As they praise a terrorist. Now, this acceptance into Interpol as a full member is dangerous for another reason, and one that has more prophetic significance. In this same report, discusses what Mahmoud Abbas said just this Monday. He said that Rafael Iran writes, on Monday, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas announced he would again put forward a resolution for Palestine to become a full member of the United Nations after its failed bid in 2011. So this is coming around again. It seems like it hasn't been that long since the last time they tried to go before the UN Security Council and say, can we be a state now? And it looks like after this acceptance into Interpol, the largest body outside the UN, that their luck might be changing. And so they are going to look forward now to try and get full member status as a state of the world. Now, this has been going on, obviously, for a long time. We've got the Palestinian Authority really making huge strides, going back to the time of the PLO, even into the Palestinian Authority now, just basically another name for it. They've tried to get other nations to come and embrace them as a state. Currently, there's 106 nations that currently recognize Palestine as an official state already. 106 nations in the world. Now, if you look back right now, I think there's 70-something, 78 or so that actually accept Kosovo as a nation, although Kosovo is a separate state with a fully-fledged government that runs itself. Yet more nations recognize Palestine as an official state. And this is kind of the way it works. This is the constitutive method of state creation. Basically, it says if other nations are willing to say you're a state, then you're a state. And that was the precedent that was set with Kosovo. That's how it became a state. The Palestinians are definitely looking to follow on from that. They want their state. Even though it might not be reflected on the ground, if the world thinks it's a state already, then that's really going to pressure Israel to make some serious concessions and some serious changes towards living next to the Palestinians. Now, Israel fears this. Israel fears that the next step for the Europeans especially is to recognize an independent Palestinian state outside of the framework of an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal. That's always been the situation, how it was going to come around, a two-state solution. The parties were going to get together. They would be brokered by an outside nation, okay, but there would be no unilateral decisions that would take place outside those negotiations, that there would be two states for two peoples, but only if it was agreed upon within the negotiation process between Israel and the Palestinians. Well, it looks like the Palestinians, again, are willing to jump ship with that and are going for worldwide public and national support. Now, this is important prophetically because we are looking at a situation here in the near future where we are going to have a negotiation process that does gather steam, not going to be negotiated by the United States, even though that's their traditional role. Instead, it's going to be negotiated by Europe. And so it makes sense then that they are reaching out to European nations now, especially to try and get them to accept them as a Palestinian state. Why wouldn't you? You just accepted, most of them have, as part of Interpol. You're willing to share information with them about capturing terrorists and other international crimes. So why not admit them or admit that they are a state? Many European nations have already done so. Germany hasn't yet. And that's probably the big one that they're going to go for. Bible prophecy indicates that there will be some type of negotiating process between the Palestinians and the Israelis brokered by Germany. Brokered by the European Union, possibly, but Germany is going to be the main thrust behind that. And these moves by the Palestinian Authority to gain international legitimacy will only increase European pressure on Israel to have a sit down again and to negotiate with the Palestinians, who they will deem eventually as a state in itself. So you can be watching for that. If you want to read more about these prophecies that where we talk about and we see how Europe is going to get more involved in the peacemaking process, you can read an article entitled The Counterfeit Peacemaker. And I'll leave that in the show notes here of today's program for you, The Counterfeit Peacemaker. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll look at the other huge event, really, that took place in the Middle East. It's getting a lot of press in northern Iraq, this referendum of Kurdistan, and talk about how it might shake things up even more in the Middle East.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're talking about the Middle East right now and how unstable it is and how it looks to become even more so in light of these two events. The first being the acceptance of the Palestinian Authority into Interpol, and looking forward to the future, the establishment or acceptance internationally of an actual Palestinian state. Well, it is interesting that at this precise time that the world seems to be pushing for a Palestinian state, that there is another state trying to get off and running. It's trying to get off and running. It has millions of people. It has an effective government that pretty much rules over it right now. It runs a lot of its own finances. You would think it's also pretty much a homogenous ethnic group. You would think that the world would say, yes, that group deserves statehood. And yet it seems that nobody is supporting it. Well, nobody apart from Israel. Funnily enough, Israel supports the establishment of a Kurdish state, a Kurdish nation. They just had a referendum this week, and this was the area in northern Iraq called Kurdistan. There are plenty of other Kurds that live both in Syria, Turkey, and even in Iran. There's about 40 million Kurds worldwide, well, living in those states of Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria, and they basically are in that corner of the globe, in the highland, a lot of the high territory there as you got into Turkey. Anyway, there was just one of those enclaves, the enclave that is inside Iraq, and they started, well, they had a vote on, I think it was Tuesday or Monday or Tuesday, for to determine whether they wanted to secede from the Iraqi government. They thought that this was the best possible time to do it, and so they had their referendum. Turns out that 90% of the 3.5 million people that voted, they said, we want out. That's a huge majority. I don't even think, now I'm going out on a limb here, but there's plenty of people, plenty of Palestinians that live inside Israel, inside the West Bank in Israel, that would say, no, I would rather stay in an Israeli state. I would rather stay in Israel because look at the opportunities for me and my family in Israel. If we were just another Arab state, cost of living would go up, quality of life would go down, infant mortality would go down, everything would go down. And so I don't think you would get even 90% of Palestinians supporting its own state. Now I'm just going out on a limb with that. And yet, we have 90% of this population who voted democratically to say, we're pretty much separate already. can we please be our own state? Now, this isn't today. We don't have a Kurdish state because they had this referendum. They basically did it as a starting point to negotiate with the Iraqi government and say, please let me have a state. Please let us have a state. Now, again, as I brought out, there aren't many people that support a Kurdish state, which I find strange, actually, because it seems like this group, this homogenous group of people, seem to check all the boxes that you would give them statehood. And yet we have basically the Israeli government that's come out and said, yep, we support their right to have an independent state. Now, this, while Kurdistan, it doesn't seem, is mentioned specifically in biblical prophecy, it is creating some waves in the Middle East, because you have these Kurds now that are willing, in some cases, to fight for their right to secede, as they see their right. Of course, the Iraqi government doesn't see it as their right. Many other nations of the world, including Iran, including Turkey, including even the United States, don't see it as their right. And yet, after this vote, they are thinking that it's time to fight for this. I want to quote from an article here by Anthony Chibariwe. It's going to be coming out on thetrumpet.com soon. And it talks about this this referendum and the situation, how it could further destabilize the Middle East. While it seems like these people should have their own state, this situation that exists right now presents a whole host of problems for states around it. And I'm going to just quote from him now. He says, an independent Kurdistan would indeed be a huge obstacle in Iran's drive to dominate the entire region, from its eastern borders and all the way up to the Mediterranean via the contiguous region of Iraq, Syria to Lebanon. The Kurds, after all, are, quote, ready like the Israelis are to fight for life, not to celebrate death, but to fight for life. That was according to one of the members of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. So you've got the Iranians that we've talked about a lot right in this program, or on this program at different times, gobbling up this territory across Iraq into Syria and into Lebanon. And while Kurdistan wouldn't put a direct stop in that, it is deeply worrying for Iran. Why is that? Well, you have Iraq that is currently in control or over this area of Kurdistan, and the Iraqi government right now is kind of at the kind of answers to Iran. They will say that they've got more independence and they might desire independence from Iran. But the fact is that right now the government of Iraq in most cases does follow what Tehran wants. What Iran wants. On September 14th, this is a couple of weeks ago, the influential Shiite leader of Iran's oldest proxy in Iraq, the Badr organization, he said that civil war would be inevitable after the vote. And then a week later, at Iraq's request, Iran imposed an air embargo on all flights to and from Kurdistan to pressure and intimidate the Kurds. And now Iran is already working with Turkey on military exercises on its border with Kurdistan. So they look like they're ready to go to war over this. Now, this is dangerous, not just for the Kurds to have the wrath of Iran fall on them, but Kurdistan and the Peshmerga, they're the ones that, basically the Kurdish army, they have been the most successful fighting force against the Islamic State. And they're digging trenches. They're ready for this. And so what you've got this situation where the Iraqis don't want the Peshmerga to secede, or to fight against them, and the Kurds to secede from them. And so what are they going to do if the Kurds decide that they're not going to buckle under the pressure that Iran, Turkey, and Iraq is trying to put on them? Well, they might have to try and force them to comply. What's going to happen if that works out? Well, the Iraqi the military right now, that's not that strong. They had to accept into their military almost 100,000 men, Shiite militias cobbled together in the PMU, the Popular Mobilization Units, that we've talked about a lot. Well, they're the main ground force right now. In fact, if you go back to when the Islamic State was taking over Kirkuk, and you had the Iraqi government they fled. The Iraqi government forces, the Iraqi military, they fled. And who remained to fight for that city? Who took it back? It was the Peshmerga. They were the Kurds. And they're the ones, if you're crossing the border into Syria, the Kurds are the ones that are fighting on behalf of the United States on the ground. You've got United States operatives that are with Kurdish fighters. They're an ally, the strongest ally apart from Israel in the region. You would think that the United States would support them. But nevertheless, we're having this situation where we might see another flashpoint here in Iraq. And it's going to only increase Iran's power over Iraq, because Iraq will need Iran's support, be it from the Iranian border or with the popular mobilization units tapping their Shiite or proxy inside Iraq to force the Peshmerga to back down, the Kurds to back down. I find it very unlikely that Kurdistan is going to exist in the near future. But I do see potentially a situation where Iran and Iraq become a whole lot closer in order to head off cessation effort by the Kurds. Now, that is something that we fully expect to happen biblical prophecy-wise. Here we have a territory inside Iraq, and we expect Iraq to fully fall to Iran, to answer to Iran in every way, to be in complete alliance with Iran. Now, this is what the Kurds said after this fight. They said, "Be assured, we will stay in these trenches. Whether it's the militias, that is the Iranian-backed militias, or ISIS, or the Iraqi army who come, this is our border, we will never leave." That's what a first lieutenant in the Peshmerga forces said. Now, what's interesting about this territory, the Kurdish territory here, it's pretty much oil-rich. And that's, they will be able to function as a separate country if they can find a purchaser for their oil. Right now, Turkey does take the oil, or pay for the oil. Pipeline from Kurdistan goes into Turkey, and that's how they've got access to outside markets. And yet, Turkey's playing hardball as well in this situation. Well, you've got the Peshmerga, the Kurds. They say that they're ready to fight for this land. But then you have the Iraqi government that said this: "We are not ready to discuss," this is the Prime Minister of Iraq, "to discuss or have a dialogue about the results of the referendum because it's unconstitutional." And then he ordered, he gave the Kurds a couple of days, time's almost running out, I think they've got one more day, to hand over full control of their airports to the central government, or else they're going to face an international embargo on all their flights coming into Kurdistan. They're going to try and shut them off, just like the Saudis have shut off Qatar. In that similar way, not for the same reasons, but in that similar way, they're going to try and cut off Kurdistan. Now, this is what an article from Middle East Eye reports. It says, "Abadi, a moderate from Iraq's Shia majority, is coming under pressure at home to take punitive measures against the Kurds. Hardline Iranian-backed Shia groups have threatened to march on Kirkuk, a territory now under Peshmerga control." They said this. This was a spokesman for a paramilitary group. "We, as the popular mobilization, would be fully prepared to carry out orders from Abadi," who basically answers to Iran in this case, "if he asked to liberate Kirkuk and the oil fields from the separatist militias." And then basically said, then Iran kind of said the same thing. This is what Iran said: "The Iraqi people won't stand silent. Iran and Turkey and other regional countries won't stand silent, and we'll stand against this abhorrent deviation." Then he says the Muslim nations will not allow the creation of a second Israel. A second Israel. Israel already exists in the Middle East, they said. Kurdistan, you want it? You've enough with your separatist policies. You've never sided with us. We're not going to allow you to become another Israel. Now, hearing that, you would think the United States would jump at the opportunity to create another Israel right on the border of Iran to counter Iran, but it doesn't look like that is going to happen. And so we've got this situation now, which is threatening to open up another battlefront against the Kurds. The Kurds have suffered a lot already. They suffered a lot under Saddam Hussein. The Kurds are the people that he was gassing, mostly. And now we've got a situation where an Iranian-dominated Iraq is going to be willing to fight against the Kurds here, which will only increase the pressure of Iran inside Iraq. And once again, if that happens, just imagine the stream of refugees once again. And this could be another situation. Wouldn't be as big as Syria, I don't think, but you do have 40 million Kurds across border lines in Syria, in Turkey, northern Iran. You have lots of Kurds, and that could just destabilize the Middle East further. And where we have a fractured state in the Middle East, Iran always vies for control. And so biblical prophecy indicates that Iran is going to be the power in this region. It doesn't necessarily say that Iran's going to conquer Kurdistan, but you can see how a fight against Kurdistan would be rationale for the Iraqis to empower the Shiite militias in their country even more and really end up in the complete takeover of Iraq by Iran. Now, in light of that as well, I've just got one more story I want to cover here quickly. It's a research paper. It's entitled "The Iran Has Emerged as the Main Victor." It's from the Cypher Brief. It's written by the director of the Iran Observer Project, and his name is Ahmed Majidaya. I'm probably butchering that. I apologize. But he writes, "Iran has emerged as the main victor in the post-Saddam Iraq. Iranian influences permeate all Iraqi political and military institutions, and Iran's Quds Force commander Qassem Soleimani commands a powerful network of Iraqi Shiite militia groups that are not entirely accountable to the Baghdad government." And I don't know if I'm going to quote any more of that, but it basically goes down the reasonings to say how in the post-Islamic State world in Iraq, Iran dominates. It's a done deal. It's a done deal, but it doesn't dominate one section of Iraq. That's Kurdistan. That's Kurdistan. Well, maybe it will even before long, that territory as well. Now, this is important. Iran's takeover of Iraq was one of the very first things that that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory talked about going back into the early 90s, 1992, 1993. Back then, said that Iraq was going to fall to Iran. Iraq was going to fall to Iran. And then when the U.S. went in there in 2003, we put that on our front cover. Will Iraq fall to Iran? And we have completely seen this prophecy take place. Iraq and Iran come together. Iraq be dominated by Iran. And I save this article here till the end. Entitled "Iran Has Emerged as the Main Victor," and it's basically talking about Iran taking over Iraq. Now, going back even 5 years, if a story like this on the mainstream press emerged, I would have spent the whole program on it. I would have talked about it for more than one program, probably, because we have been waiting for this to happen for so long, and yet these come out every week now, talking about how Iran controls this territory of Iraq. But go back, you can go back to 2003, you can go back before then, you can read our booklet, The King of the South, and it documents the times at which we first said that Iraq was going to fall to Iran, and there was nobody out there that was really saying that. Post-2003, yes, some people did say, if the United States goes into Iraq, then it's going to destabilize the power balance of the region, and that Iran would eventually take over. But go back another 10 years. Go back another 10 years when Saddam Hussein inside Iraq was powerful. Powerful to the point that they could go toe-to-toe with Iran. Powerful to the point that people were worried that Iraq would dominate Iran. And yet, based on biblical prophecy, we're able to say that no, it is going to be Iraq that will dominate Iran. And now that is happening to a T. To the point now that you've got Iran coming out and saying, "Hey, Kurds, if you don't back down, Kurds in Iraq, if you don't back down, we're coming to get you. Not just the Iraqis, but we're going to come and get you as well," because they deem Iraq as their state. And if Kurdistan wants to try and break away from Iraq, Iran sees that as them trying to break away from Iran. And it's not going to stand for it. And that is why Iran is, as the Bible calls it, the King of the South. the King of the South. And why are we watching the King of the South? Of course, it's because the other prophecies that talk about the King of the South and what they do. They don't just gobble up Iraq. They gobble up other nations as well. They start aligning themselves with other nations, such as Yemen, such as Egypt, even pushing over into Libya, such as even Ethiopia, the Bible says that Iran will eventually ally with. And what is this King of the South going to do? The King of the South is going to push at the King of the North, as you've heard so many times on this program, the King of the North, the Europeans, which already are feeling the effects. They're feeling the effects of turmoil in the Middle East that is largely created by Iran. Now, that's why this is prophetic. That's why we're following this so much, this story about Iran's growth throughout the Middle East. And it's doing anything but stabilize the Middle East. I just want to conclude now from a quote from our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury. He wrote a letter to members of the Philadelphia Church of God and also co-worker letters that support our message. This is what he said. He said, "Nevertheless, nuclear technology from North Korea could still play a major role in events during the end time ahead, especially as it gets into the hands of Iranians. That's coming. We're looking for that to happen. North Korea can give some of its nuclear material technology to the Iranians if they don't create one first. This King of the South." Then he writes further down, "This mad world is about to exterminate itself." That's where these events are leading. And yet, as he goes on here to talk about, this isn't the end of the story. It might be where these events are leading. It might be painful for a time, but that's not where these events are leading. As I talked about at the beginning of the show, right now we are in the middle of these full holy days, the holy days that really do show us God's plan, his plan for mankind. They show us exactly what he is doing here on this earth. And while biblical prophecy does reveal a lot of the intricacies of the events to take place in this end time, the Bible also reveals through these holy days what event, supernatural event, is to happen next. And that's what he writes here. These full holy days, such as the Feast of Tabernacles, Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, these full holy days picture a new civilization ruled by Christ. In the world's darkest hour, God is revealing an imminent future full of light and hope. We see a dying civilization filled with catastrophe, he writes. And don't we see that in the Middle East? A dying civilization filled everywhere with catastrophe. But he says that's about to be replaced by the most inspiring civilization ever seen on this earth. That's where it leads to. That's where those prophecies that talk about the King of the South pushing the King of the North lead to. This inspiring change for the Middle East. Change that's going to start in the Middle East and spread all over the world. All over the world. And you can read about that as well in the book of the King, in booklet The King of the South. You can also read about it in our booklet Jerusalem in Prophecy, that talks about this inspiring conclusion to these catastrophic end time events that will most definitely happen, just as sure as you see Iran taking over Iraq this day. That's all we have time for today. Thanks very much for listening, and you can tune into the program tomorrow.